be seated. I believe we have students with us today. Is that right? Do we have students? Pardon me? They were in the other room? Okay. We have students with us today from Newman Catholic High School, but they are not noticeable in
from
this
Wausau,
room.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
Newman Catholic High School, I'm advised, from Wausau, Wisconsin, the home but not birthplace of Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, former home. Oh, you're right, current home. Former home is Richland Center. Pardon me? Some did.
Oh, I see.
All right.
Them right here.
Okay. Are all of them here or some? Some. Okay. Now that we have that straight, this is a little harder than even deciding this case. Would these students from Newman Catholic High School please stand? Come on. Well, I have 10 on my note, and 4 are here. Does that mean 6 are upstairs or 6 didn't show? 6 are upstairs. Okay. So we have less than half of the students here. Thank you. You may be seated. And we want to thank you all for coming. And as I explained in the earlier case, but the 4 students weren't here as well as others, the students are here with a national award-winning program cleverly entitled Court with Class, in which we ask students across the state if they would be willing to come to Madison and listen to an oral argument. And if the students accept the invitation, material about the case is sent to the class. Class may engage in activities related to the case or not. And then the students come to hear an oral argument. And after the second oral argument of the day, which is this one that we are about to hear, a justice assigned for the day meets with the students and anyone else who wishes to come, and the discussion is procedural. How does the court accept cases? How does the court decide cases? How do we mandate our opinions? The discussion after this case is not about the substantive issues in the case. So we welcome the students. Does anyone present want a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, please raise your hand, and Kevin Pond, the deputy marshal, will give the summary. Kevin? Oh, several. All right. There's some in the back, Marshall.
There's quite a few.
Pardon me?
There's quite a few.
Hard to tell. Because I think this is sent to them, but I'm not sure because they're late. Yeah. Really
good that there's happening. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rokensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Generally don't do this from the bench, but is that Phil Phillips seated next to you? Miss Phillips, I haven't seen you for a long time. Welcome and happy birthday. I read in the newspaper you're celebrating your 90th birthday. And I have to tell you that although I'm not 90, my distance vision is receding, so I had a little trouble deciding whether you were or were not Phil Phillips, even after all these years. So I'm somewhat embarrassed by that. But it's an important celebration, and we join you in that, and we join you in celebrating 90 years of commitment to justice.
Thanks so much. It's good to see you again.
Thanks. Maybe we should have lunch. All right. I'll now proceed to call this case 12 AP 1652. Milwaukee branch of the NAACP v. Scott Walker. Arguing, let me read the list we have so there's no issues. 18 minutes for Clayton Patrick Kowski, Assistant Attorney General, who's now shifted to the other side of the table because they are the petitioners here. 7 minutes, you'll get the same seven. Michael Morley, who represents the intervener, and I will again allow pro hoc vici admission. 30 minutes for Richard Sachs, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Kowski. Right? Okay. Mr. Kowski. We generally don't put cases together where an attorney has to argue two cases on the same day, but today did for obvious reasons.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Clay Kosky appearing on behalf of the defendants, and I also have with me today Assistant Attorney General Maria Lazar at counsel table. I have three main points. First, as to the relief requested, this court should reverse the judgment of the circuit court that granted a permanent injunction enjoining the voter ID law. The injunction should be lifted and the law should be allowed to go into effect. Second, and importantly, this case involves only a facial challenge to the law. It does not involve as-applied claims that the law is applied unconstitutionally as to particular individuals. There are no as-applied claims under the Wisconsin Constitution. Finally, the evidence presented at trial showed only that in 2012, approximately 10% of registered Wisconsin voters then lacked a form of qualifying ID. There is no evidence in the trial record to conclude that this same 10% population is also unable to get the ID. It's a very important point because the plaintiffs are asking this court to facially invalidate this law as applied to all Wisconsin voters, despite the fact that we know from the trial record that more than 90% of Wisconsinites, without doing anything more, can already comply with the law.
You know, I don't understand this. If I go in November and I have a driver's license, I'm in compliance, right?
You're able to show, yep, use the driver's license to show proof of identification.
In X number of years, and I've forgotten what they are, I have to renew my license.
I believe it's 6 years.
Okay. Well, it might be left on my license 1 year. So if, when I go in and I get my license again renewed, do I have to show a birth certificate?
I don't believe you do.
That's it. I'm okay.
Correct. I believe that's true.
And when I register, when I go to vote, I don't have to follow. I don't have to show a birth certificate or Social Security, anything, just my driver's license.
You don't have to show a birth certificate or a Social Security card. You might use a driver's license as one of the documents to register.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So your answer is you do not have to show your birth certificate or a Social Security card in renewing your driver's license.
That is not my answer.
But that's my question.
Okay.
My question is, hey, without Act 23, I'm okay. As soon as I renew my license, I have to show it as if I've never had a license before. I've got to show my birth certificate, right?
I don't believe that's true. I believe you can use the old ID card to renew your license. This is something that can definitely be confirmed in the regulations.
Well, I confirmed in the regulation that they can give me a waiver. I confirmed that the statute does not so authorize the Department of Transportation. The statute authorizes waivers for a limited number of things, not because my father has a tough time, because he's not in a facility and he doesn't fit within it. So let's just talk about the statute.
And when we're talking about the statute, you do mean the voter ID law, not the driver's license requirement statute.
I'm talking to get a voter ID, I need a driver's license. I go to renew my driver's license. What do I have to do for that? Do I have to show a birth certificate?
I think you could actually use your old ID, because you already have one. You could use that to renew your driver's license.
Even though I didn't have to show anything at that time.
There are other things that you have to show. It's possible, and I don't have these regulations memorized. There are things that we could easily turn to DMV publications to confirm what you would need to renew.
I'm indicating that you really don't know whether when I renew a driver's license, I have to show my birth certificate.
I don't know, but I don't think you have to.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I would say, Mr. Koski, that when I renewed my driver's license in February of last year to get a real ID, a new statute of some sort, they expected me to produce a birth certificate.
That might be a federal provision.
That is a good point, Justice Prosser. So there are now two different types of IDs that the DMV issues. Real ID compliant IDs and Real ID non-compliant IDs. My understanding is that the non-compliant IDs, which are allowed for voting under Act 23, would allow certain waiver procedures. If you want the federal Real ID compliant ID, you do have to show a birth certificate.
I had to drive to Atlanta to get my birth certificate. I had to go to the bank, safety deposit box. It was inconvenient to do that. But...
sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Lost your key and they had to blast it open at great expense.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a couple of year period and then everyone is going to be required to get a federal real ID?
I believe that's true, but I'm not sure. I think that the law does require that all IDs will be real ID compliant, but I'm not sure.
That's at least my impression.
I think that is true. Again, I'm not sure. I want to point out the first point, substantive point that I made. This law is a facial challenge. Under a facial challenge, this court has stated in State versus Wood, 323 Wis. 2nd, 321 at paragraph 13, that the challenger must show that the law cannot be enforced under any circumstances. The plaintiffs are asking is that this law be facially invalidated, even though we already know from the trial court record that it is valid as to not more than 90% of folks that already have a Wisconsin driver license or state ID card.
If this law disenfranchised 10%, you're saying it's valid for 90%. If it disenfranchised 10%, is that would that be a sufficient showing in your mind to sustain the burden of facial constitutional invalidity?
I don't know.
How many people is 10% in this state? I mean, I thought your response was going to be, well, if it destroyed their right, I mean, we can't have 10% of the people with a destroyed right.
Right. I think this court's case law actually has, there's one case I found that talks about what percentage is kind of a trigger percentage. And I think maybe that's what you're aiming at, Justice
Breyer. No, I'm not aiming at that case. I'm aiming that I think for me it's breathtaking if the state takes the position that legislation that would disenfranchise, I'm not talking about a burden, a substantial burden, or a severe burden, whatever the test is. I said disenfranchise, destroy the right to vote. That wouldn't be enough?
That is not this case.
No, I'm asking you.
I don't know if that would be enough. I guess it would be up to this court to decide, but that case is not before this court today. My point with regard to the 10% is that the plaintiffs essentially only proved half of what they needed to get there for a facial challenge. They showed that there's 10% of folks that currently lacked ID. They didn't show that 10% is disenfranchised.
No.
They didn't show that that 10% all lacks birth certificates. They didn't go that extra step of demonstrating that those folks that lack ID either cannot get it or would be so burdened that they're essentially disenfranchised.
And, counsel, that's really why I started out with the disenfranchise question. Disenfranchise is tantamount to destroy. But that's not the whole test. The test is whether or not the right is destroyed or, depending on what words you use, substantially infringed, substantially impaired, a severe burden. So just because the right is not destroyed for 10% of our voting population doesn't end the inquiry. The test then also asks us whether or not if it is a severe enough burden or a substantial enough impairment that it does not meet constitutional standards facially. Am I correct?
I do agree with that. And I think that really highlights why this case cannot succeed as a facial challenge. We don't know whether it's a severe enough burden based on the record that was presented at trial. The plaintiffs only showed who lacks ID. They did not show that those folks also cannot get ID. And that is really, I think, key to the analysis.
Well, then we're missing something, because I hear part of your argument now saying they haven't shown that they're unable to, which to me is tantamount to destroying the right, totally disenfranchising. I'm saying that our test, in fact, I'm looking at page 16 of your brief, and the test is not just destroy, and it isn't in the context of facial challenges. I'm looking at page 16 of your brief where you cite the Washington State Grange case versus Republican Party, and you say, and the United States Supreme Court sometimes takes a modified approach to facial challenges when the challenge statute allegedly burdens constitutionally protected conduct, such as free speech. In such contexts, a challenge law is not required to be invalid in all applications, but will be strictly scrutinized if there is evidence that it imposes burdens on a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct that are severe enough and widespread enough. You know, I guess off the cuff, I think 10% of our voting population, if their right is totally destroyed, that's widespread. I mean, that causes me to pause, but I think you're not there yet. So it's severe enough and widespread enough to be excessive in relation to the law's legitimate purpose. I assume that you cited that on page 16 of your brief because you think that's a test that is appropriate to be applied in this case, where you have this argument of whether it's a facial challenge or it should be an as-applied challenge. You've got this, what you would call modified approach.
I think that's right. I want to clarify. The 10%, I'm not saying that, or we're not taking the position that they have to be disenfranchised to meet the test. The test we cite in our brief, as you point out, is severe and widespread burdens. So if the burdens are both severe and widespread, that can cause a facial challenge to prevail. What we're saying, though, is that the trial record doesn't show that there are severe and widespread burdens.
And if I recall, in your brief, you cite, I think, in Crawford, where they define severe as also substantial. That's one of the headings, I think, in your reply brief, substantial.
Yes, I think that's right. And so what Crawford does, and we are advocating that the proper test is essentially the Crawford test. Crawford first looks at whether the burdens are severe or whether they're not. And it also looks at whether the law is uniformly applied. I believe what the Crawford court first questions is whether you have a reasonable non-discriminatory restriction. And that is what the Crawford Supreme Court said was Burdick versus Takushi, 504 U.S. at 434. Our position is that this is a reasonable law. It has a reasonable purpose, which is proving voter identity, and that it is non-discriminatory. It applies across the board. So it meets that. When that is the case, the Crawford court said that the test is that a court evaluating a constitutional challenge to an election regulation should weigh the asserted injury to the right to vote against the precise interests put forward by the state as justifications for the burden imposed by its rule. Crawford, 553 U.S. at 190.
Okay. I want to direct you in a little different way than
sure.
has been talked about today.
Are you done with the answer to the question?
There's another thing I'd like to say.
Crawford,
I would like to come back to Crawford. The other thing I wanted to say in that answer is the case that I pointed out. I'm sorry, Justice Jorgensack. The case I wanted to point out where this court held that 40% of people being disenfranchised was fundamentally unfair is McNally versus Tolander. That is a case where this court, if there's some litmus test, that was it. That's the only case I see in this court's jurisprudence that they said this is some litmus test, some percentage, and we can say that this is automatically a bad result.
If I may, Crawford specifically eschews any litmus test, however.
That is correct. That is correct. And I think that McNally was such a severe example. You had 40% of voters that were denied a ballot. And I think we could all agree that that is problematic. I'm sorry, Justice Jorgensack.
No, that's fine. My colleagues are done. I'm ready to go. My concern is that for someone that doesn't have a birth certificate, there has to be a payment made to get that birth certificate. Now, it may not apply to me. I already have a driver's license. But anybody that doesn't have a birth certificate, it appears from the statute that there's a requirement that they make a payment, and the payment goes to the state. And what bothers me is that this feels, though not universally, as was the case in Harper, where there was a dollar and a half poll tax, it's still a payment to the state to be able to vote. That bothers me. Can you address that? Are there ways that people, and it doesn't matter to me if people are poor or they can afford the $20 for the certified birth certificate, I'm troubled by having to pay the state to vote.
And I guess I'll answer. There are two ways to answer that question. The first is that Crawford was a case in which it was the court noted in a footnote that in Indiana you also had to pay a fee for a birth certificate. And the court was not uncomfortable with that. And it was a facial challenge as well. So the Supreme Court was not uncomfortable with that situation. One other thing I'll say is that as a practical matter, since the voter ID law, when it was in place, it was going to be in place, there were some places in Wisconsin that offered free birth certificates. Milwaukee County offered free birth certificates to those that lived in Milwaukee County. I believe Dane County made a proposal to offer free birth certificates, but I don't recall if it was passed.
There is a section of the statute that deals with this. You know, 6922 talks about fees. And if you go down to subsection 6, it does say that the county can authorize birth certificates without payment, but that would be county by county. It also says the state registrar may charge a reasonable fee for providing searches and copies for state agencies' program use. And I guess my concern is, frankly, trying to find a way that no one has to pay the state in order to vote if they don't have what they need.
And I think that in this case, I want to bring the folks back. It's a facial challenge. There will be folks that that to get their birth certificate have to pay a fee. What if you don't live in Milwaukee County, for example? Certainly that is true. State's position is, though, there has to be severe and widespread burdens demonstrated to facially invalidate a law.
So what you're saying to me is what I'm troubled with may be as-applied challenges for people in the future, but it isn't enough for a facial challenge. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Yes.
How far, in your opinion, so what's the state's position? How many, for instance, here we have a finding, 333,000 people don't have the required identification, as I recall that finding. Now, are you contending that those folks should be bringing individually as applied challenges? I ask almost rhetorically, because I hope the answer is no. It leads me to really the question of how many as applied do you need in order to be widespread? That goes back to what we were talking about. But what's the state's position on that?
Well, I think the answer is no, the state is not taking the position we should have 300,000+ as applied challenges. For one, we don't even know if those 300,000 would have valid as applied challenge. I see my light is out, but I will finish the answer to this question. Say we had 322,000 folks or whatever the number is that currently lack an ID. If they are not severely burdened in getting the ID, I don't see how they'd have an as-applied challenge that would survive. So if say we had a million, we had 1 million, and it could only be shown that 999,999 people could get the ID tomorrow, I don't think that you'd have 999,999 as-applied challenges. It needs to focus more on whether there are burdens that were shown that are severe and widespread, and this trial record just does not show that.
Is there anything that the state could do that, in your mind, violates the Wisconsin Constitution? Give me an example. Is there an identity card that a requirement that they can't
I think I can give an example.
And I'm not interested in race or gender, obviously.
Sure.
Disabilities, go ahead, or any other suspect classification.
I wasn't going to go towards suspect classifications, but I do have another theory as to something the state could do that would have a foundation in the case law as to something that would be inappropriate.
Okay.
I believe the case law, this court's case law, talks about and I think the interveners even point out somewhere around like page 20 of their brief, they cite a number of cases in which it was not the elector's fault that they did something wrong. It was the fault of an election official. Say, for example, I believe there's a case, and the name eludes me right now, where the ballots had to be initialed by two different people. Instead, one person initialed both of them. And the question was whether those ballots could be counted. And the court held that they could be counted because it was the election official's mistake, not the voters. So this court has case law that says
that's a violation of the statute by a government official. I want to know what legislative provision, in your opinion, that were enacted would be this kind of burden.
Well, say you had a law that only you had to be left-handed to vote.
Pardon me?
You have to be left-handed to vote in Wisconsin. I think that would be extremely problematic, and we could all agree that that might violate Article 3, Section 1. So that would be one example.
So you'd have to be absolutely, yeah, you're not even sure about that, huh? So you'd have to have something that's absolutely ludicrous on its face.
And I think that does sound ludicrous to me. So I would agree that...
Is there anything short of absolute ludicrous on its face that would violate...
Another way of saying that, which would be a little more to the point, I think, would destroy the right of those who are not left-handed to vote.
I think that's 90% of the people.
Well, and that would be over the 40%, which this court has set as a parameter so far. So, but what I hear you say is that would not just impair the right, but that would destroy the right of, if the Chief Justice's percentage is correct, and I have no reason to think it's not, 90% of the people to vote. However, the regulations that we're discussing here today, and some reference was made from the bench about certain inconveniences of residing in one county and working in another and having to go to collect one's birth certificate in one's county of birth. That brings me back to something we talked about in the last hearing, but I think is pertinent here, which is the conflation of inconvenience with impairment of a right. A felon, right now, does not have the right to vote. Everyone else, so long as they meet the requirements of the Constitution, has the right to vote. And everyone agrees that the state has the ability to reasonably regulate that right. So I think that hypothetical, and the reason why I went to it so quickly, is because I think that illustrates the difference between the impairment or the destruction of a right as opposed to a regulation which may result in some inconvenience, but which is not constitutionally impermissible.
And Justice Gavelin, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it actually has a basis in the case law. In Crawford, 553 U.S. at 197 and 98, the court talked about burdens. And it talked about burdens such as a voter who may lose his photo identification, have his wallet stolen on the way to the polls, may not resemble the photo in the identification because he grew a beard. These are burdens that the court characterizes arising from life's vagaries. That's the term they use.
In the previous hearing, Mr. Pines, towards the end, conceded that if the state were to remove all economic barriers or hindrances to getting the proper identification, that then, I think he says, probably it would be constitutional. Does this court have the authority to construe legislation, to interpret it in such a way to make it constitutional by removing those parts of it which are not constitutional? For instance, if there are members of the bench who believe that the payment would be tantamount to a poll tax, if the state removes all those or is compelled by this court's construction of the legislation, may we do that?
I think this court could do that. We have not taken the position in our briefing that that the court should do that.
Sure.
I think
you're relying, quite logically, on the language from the United States Supreme Court where they did not object to such payment. But if that were the case, does this court have the authority to construe it in a constitutional manner?
Yes.
Of course, the payment is not in this Act 23, is it?
That's correct. The payment of $20 for a birth certificate is from another statute.
And so we would have to be declaring that of the statute as not applicable under certain circumstances.
Right. That's correct.
Without giving anyone an opportunity to argue the applicability of that statute. You're not arguing that.
We're not arguing that.
And you're not arguing that it's an economic issue here.
We're not arguing that. We're arguing on this record it hasn't been shown to be an economic issue.
Okay.
And you're also arguing that it can wait for a as-applied challenge.
I don't think we're arguing that, but we're arguing that as applied challenges, there are some that could be out there lurking. This case is about facial challenges.
Right, but if someone can't afford, if someone is absolutely broke, and they can't afford the $20, they would be free to bring an as-applied challenge. Justice Ziegler pointed that out in the previous year.
Yes, they would be free to bring an as-applied challenge.
How many elections would they miss?
I don't know.
Thank you, Counsel. Well,
I'd like to ask
Justice Prosser.
The circuit court in this case made some extensive findings of fact, particularly with relation to Professor Mayer. How is this court supposed to take those findings of fact? Must we accept them, or what's your view on what we should do with those findings
sure.
of fact?
I think that the findings of fact, if they're clearly erroneous, that the court should not accept them. One thing I'll point out about Professor Mayer's and Professor Hood, who was the state's expert's conclusions, they're very similar in terms of the number of folks that lack ID. I think Professor Mayer, somewhere in the 322,000 range. Professor Hood is very close. I think he's 302,000. So that issue, I mean, yes, 20,000 people, that's a number that is different. But as far as if we're talking about 300,000 versus 5, that would be a very significant difference. We're talking about 300,000 compared to 322, which is not a significant difference. So I would say that the factual findings, we're not asking that factual findings be overturned because, in fact, our expert had very similar findings. It just happened that the circuit court cited Professor Mayer's findings.
I think Justice Prosser's question is similar to something I would ask, but for your red light. What's the burden of proof? How do we review this? What is our standard of review?
Well,
a lot of cases here hinge on that.
Sure. We believe that the primary question is a question of law. The question about factual findings is clear error review. So I don't think this case focuses mostly on factual
findings. What is the burden to prove a statute unconstitutional?
Well, in this case, they'd have to demonstrate, again, based on the case we argue it applies from the Crawford case, they'd have to demonstrate that the there's a couple of things they'd have to demonstrate. First of all, I'm pointing to Crawford 553 U.S. at 191. The burden that the state places on the voter must be justified by relevant and legitimate state interests sufficiently weighty to justify the limitation. So they'd have to show that there are no such interests. I've already pointed out how they didn't show that there are severe and widespread burdens based on this record. They showed that there are 10% of folks that in 2012 lack the ID. They didn't show that all those folks can't get the ID or even that they'd be burdened in getting the ID. They just didn't go that extra step. So they're starting with the burden. From the state's point of view, they haven't demonstrated that the burden is severe and widespread, which is what they'd have to do to prevail in a facial challenge.
I have a question which I'd like you to ponder and handle in rebuttal. As I read the briefs, they view the state interest as preventing corrupt voting against in violation of the law. I think the state policy in election law is to enable as many qualified voters as can be to vote, because that is the basic structure of a democratic society. And it seems to me that one of the standards should be, does this promote widespread voting of those who are qualified and eligible to vote? Think about that.
Thank you.
All right. Now, if I can find my paper, I can call Mr. Morley for 7 minutes. That's all right, Mr. Trujillo.
Oh, okay, he's in. Very good. Thank you.
You don't have a speaking part in this case.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. And again, thank you for the privilege of addressing the court on this issue. I'd like to briefly touch on three issues. The first is the question that the Chief Justice closed with about protecting the right to vote. The U.S. Supreme Court recognized that the right to vote is comprised of both an affirmative and a negative or a defensive component. The court held in Reynolds v. Sims that an individual's right of suffrage is denied by a debasement or dilution of the weight of his vote just as much as if that person were not permitted to vote at all. In Anderson versus United States, the court said that the fundamental right to vote has to include the right of all voters to have their expressions of choice be, quote, given full value and effect without being diluted or distorted by the casting of fraudulent ballots. So while the Chief Justice is absolutely correct that making the franchise accessible to everyone is one way of preserving the right to vote, casting that ballot is meaningless unless there are also sufficient safeguards in place to make sure it isn't canceled out, it isn't diluted by improperly cast ballots, ballots not cast by eligible or qualified electors. And so therefore, under the right to vote is recognized by the Supreme Court, both aspects need to be taken into account.
Good. So how does this law take into account making it accessible to all? I understand to avoid corrupt votes, but how does it make it accessible to all?
The waiver provision that we discussed earlier is one way that for individuals.
I checked the statute, counsel, and the statute does not have a waiver provision for my father.
Your Honor is absolutely correct, and that actually leads into the second point that I was hoping to address here. To the issues that the plaintiffs that the record shows exists with accessing voter ID don't arise from Act 23 itself. If this court looks at the complaint, specifically paragraphs 50 to 55, the types of difficulties that people face in obtaining ID are long drives to the DMV, long lines at the DMV. As Your Honor pointed out, having to pay for birth certificates. None of these are actually aspects of Act 23. So citing these types of difficulties as a basis for holding Act 23 facially invalid is a non sequitur, because none of the circumstances that gives rise to the allegedly unconstitutional burden come from Act 23 itself, but rather they come from the implementation of the way in which DMV offices are located, whether or not satellite locations are established in areas that are distant from DMV offices. So the problem, if any, lies not in Act 23's photo identification requirement, but through other circumstances that this court can address through its broad powers of equity with more narrowly tailored in measures.
And I've forgotten if it's your brief in this case or your brief in the other case, you indicated, unlike the state, how this could be narrowly tailored. Was it this brief or the other brief? I'm sorry.
A little bit of both, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So you're saying, hey, the court finds it too broad. How do you narrow it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. To the extent, and again, Your Honor raised the excellent point before, to the extent that truly indigent people are being locked out of voting because they can't afford a birth certificate, the solution is not to invalidate Act 23. The solution is to help them get the birth certificate. The solution is to hold that it would be unconstitutional to deny them the birth certificate, not unconstitutional to have a broad the photo identification requirement that over 90% of the population can meet. This court, through its broad equity powers, is able to uphold the constitutionality of the statute while addressing the problems that arise through circumstances outside of the statute.
Mr. Morley, let me ask you a question about a case that you mentioned a few minutes ago. You mentioned the Anderson case. There is a follow-up case, the Burdick case, but they really go hand in hand. And they talk about a balancing test, where you're balancing the burden of the act as against the benefit from the act. Do you think that's an appropriate approach for us to take here?
One point I'd point out, the Anderson case that I'm citing is not Anderson versus Celebrezze. It's United States versus Anderson. So it's a different Anderson standard.
But you're aware of the Anderson case I'm talking about in the Burdick case, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Do you think that the balancing test is appropriate here?
I think that were this a federal constitutional challenge, that would be appropriate. I think that this court over the decades has articulated a different standard that the state has talked about where in the earlier conversations with regard to destruction of the right to vote, substantial impairment of the right to vote. So this court's precedents don't really get into the type of balancing that one sees more in the Burdick versus Takushi line of cases in federal courts.
Do you think that our cases get to a heightened level of scrutiny?
Beyond a pure rational basis standard, I would say so, Your Honor. To the extent that it becomes practically impossible for someone to vote, the law would be unconstitutional as applied to that person or to people in those particular sets of circumstances, which leads back to Your Honor's earlier point. There wouldn't, to the extent that 300,000 people are substantially burdened, and again, we're not taking the position that they are, but if this court were to conclude that they are, that does not necessarily mean the law is facially unconstitutional. Class actions could be brought to bring the as-applied challenges for the groups of people who are adversely affected in particular ways, or, again, this court could simply alleviate the need for that through a remedy that is narrowly tailored at the actual causes of the constitutional deficiencies.
Given this is a fundamental right to vote, should we apply a strict scrutiny standard?
Well, no, Your Honor, because the issue here is whether or not regulations on the right to vote are constitutional, and this actually leads into my third point, which is that just as I had argued in the Lee case, at least as applied to federal elections, the proper standard that because the power to regulate federal elections comes from the U.S. Constitution, it's not subject to the fetters or the constraints of the state constitution, the U.S. House of Representatives, in resolving an election contest, the United States Senate in issuing a report on reforming the Electoral College, your sister Supreme Courts in Rhode Island, Kentucky, New Hampshire, have all recognized that state constitutions cannot limit the scope of state legislatures' authority to regulate federal elections. The NAACP argues that this court shouldn't consider that argument because it's waived, but this court has the power to consider additional arguments on issues raised below. The issue here is whether the state constitution renders Act 23 unconstitutional, and interveners are presenting the argument that at least with regard to federal elections, it doesn't. This is a pure question of law for which no additional evidence is necessary, for which there's no prejudice to this court considering it, and so this court certainly has the broad discretion to ensure that it is setting the correct precedent on this issue, especially because state constitutional challenges to election laws will arise again. This court certainly has broad discretion to consider this new argument concerning the same fundamental issue that was raised below, and the interveners respectfully urge the court to do so.
To federal elections. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll next hear from Attorney Richard Sachs representing the plaintiffs here, which is the Milwaukee branch of the NAACP and various and Voces de la Frontera and other individuals. Counsel?
May it please the court. Richard Sachs of Hawks Quindell. I'm here with my co-counsel Michelle Samara and Barbara Quindell on behalf of the plaintiffs in this matter. Thank you. There are three numbers that, two of which you've heard, one you haven't heard yet, which are really at the heart of our case. The first number is the 333,276 qualified Wisconsin electors who lack an Act 23 acceptable photo ID. The second number is 20, and 20 is the number of dollars that many of those voters will have to pay in order to get the underlying documentation required in order to vote, get an Act 23 acceptable photo ID. The third number, which goes to the issue that Justice Crooks raised about balancing, and that number is zero, because zero is the number of times a person in Wisconsin has been arrested, prosecuted, or convicted for the only type of vote fraud that would be prevented or deterred by Act 23, which is voter impersonation. Now, Justice Ziegler raised the issue about what's the correct standard of review that this court should employ in terms of construing and analyzing and assessing the constitutionality of Act 23. We submit that that standard should be heightened scrutiny, requiring careful consideration of the purpose of the law and the benefits of the law, weighed against the substantial burdens that it imposes. And the reason for this is in order to protect the fundamental right to vote, which is explicitly guaranteed by our Constitution. And when we talk about the right to vote being fundamental, this court has characterized it as not just fundamental, but as inherent, as sacred, as precious. And the United States Supreme Court has distinguished it from all the other fundamental rights by calling it preservative. Preservative because if it's undermined, all other rights, and the legitimacy of our institutions become undermined.
Mr. Sachs, how does heightened scrutiny differ from strict scrutiny, if at all?
I'm not sure it does. I think whether you use the term heightened, this court has never employed the precise term strict scrutiny in its jurisprudence in the 150 years in which it's decided cases brought under Article 3, Section 1. Rather, I think the methodology that the trial court used is very instructive. What the trial court said was every time this court has construed a right to vote, it's carefully looked at the law. It's carefully looked at the burdens that it imposed on voters. It's carefully assessed the purposes of the statute and whether it advanced the state's interest, not only, as Justice Abrahamson said, in urging people to vote, but there is a state interest. There is a state interest in ensuring that there's fair and orderly elections in which the integrity of the election process is protected. That's an important state interest, but it also has to be balanced and weighed against what are the burdens that the law imposes on voters. And to find the law unconstitutional does not mean that we have to find that the law absolutely disenfranchises or practically disenfranchises or makes it virtually impossible to vote. Rather, the principle that can be gleaned from this court is that the law can impose burdens that make it so difficult or inconvenient or impractical that it hampers the right to vote. There's a number of cases coming in the U.S. Supreme Court which don't find absolute disenfranchisement, but nonetheless struck down laws. The $1.50 poll tax in Harper, many of those voters voted. They weren't absolutely disenfranchised, but the $1.50 poll tax was an invalid statement of the law. Likewise, the Supreme Court struck down, for example, small procedural windows in which voters could register. Not everybody was disenfranchised. Not all those voters were absolutely disenfranchised, but it was a cumbersome and procedural hurdle that hampered and handicapped.
Those are all facial challenges. Was it ever challenged about the test that used to be given in the South as to your knowledge of the Constitution? It was given to some people, but not others.
That's correct.
That's correct. Was that challenged along with the poll tax?
Yes.
Not upheld?
No.
Okay.
And we would say that this approach of balancing the burdens against the benefits of the law is an approach that the United States Supreme Court currently employs in voting rights cases. And it's similar. The two approaches can be harmonized. They're not different. And so that's why we're not that concerned about whether the term utilized is heightened or strict or demanding. The point is that this court has always taken a careful look at the law. Take a careful look. The state would have you say, well, there's fraud, and that's a legitimate purpose, and therefore the law should be approved. That's not the approach that we're encouraging that we think should be taken.
Counsel, where does the balancing test come into play with regard to the strict scrutiny or heightened level of scrutiny? Is it the performing of the balancing test and the results of that test that could lead you to conclude burden versus interest, that this requires heightened level of scrutiny, or is it the nature of the right involved? Is it where a statute implicates a fundamental interest, it's the obligation of a court to apply a strict or heightened level of review to the statute to determine if it remains within the range of authority permitted under the Constitution?
I think in all candor, the mere fact that a voting regulation is implicated and the right to vote has some relationship to the claim that's involved doesn't automatically trigger strict scrutiny. That's not the position. And that's not what the Anderson verdict scale says. It says that you have to make an assessment of what's the severity of the burden that's imposed, and how widespread is that burden imposed upon the electorate? And then based upon those burdens, that'll determine how careful are we going to take a look at the state's asserted interest in the law. And we're not just talking about whether or not the state's interest is legitimate. That's not the only issue as to whether the state's interest is legitimate. It's also a question of what's the strength of the state's interest in the passage of the law, and also whether the law is necessary to accomplish the state's asserted purposes of the law. So it's not just simply a matter of saying, oh, we have a law that's deterring vote fraud. That's a legitimate interest. We'll put the seal of approval of imprimatur of the courts onto this law. It's a question of, does the state have a strong interest in it, and is it necessary? And if we look at the facts in this case, if we look at the facts that were presented in this case, the state presented zero evidence in this case in terms of why this law was strongly needed to deter vote fraud and protect the electoral integrity of the electoral process in Wisconsin. There was no evidence presented from the considerations regarding the legislative record, and there was no external evidence that was presented either.
Was it the state's burden to prove that?
Well, we presented evidence. We provided evidence. Which from task forces that were convened in Wisconsin in 2004 by the Milwaukee Police Department and the mayor in Milwaukee, and then in 2008, a task force by Attorney General Van Hollen, along with state prosecutors across the state.
You presented evidence because you were bringing the lawsuit, so you had a burden, right?
We did have a burden first,
and what was your burden of proof?
We obviously have a burden to prove that the law is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, and we believe that we carried the burden on that issue that the state does not have a strong interest in deterring fraud through the passage of a photo ID requirement, and there was no evidence to the contrary of the evidence that we presented.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying the state had to
No, we're not saying it was their burden. Okay. What we're saying is that we presented evidence that was unrebutted. And the only thing that the state relied upon, is that stopping fraud is a legitimate interest in the abstract, and they cite Crawford for that. And they also say that, well, just because, and perception, and that the perception of fraud is a legitimate interest. In other words, to assuage the public's concern that we're enacting legislation to preserve the integrity of the electoral process. But
Mr. Sachs, could I ask a question? In the old days when I used to be involved in campaigns and elections, I noticed that on the voters' list, there were often names of people who had not voted for years, some of whom were dead, moved away. When we talk about the statewide voter registration system, how has that changed my perception of things?
Well, I would like to point out to you, Justice Prosser, that that was a legitimate concern that prompted the court's decision in Crawford, that in the record in Indiana in the Crawford case showed that the voter rolls were inflated by a factor of about 150% in terms of the actual rolls versus legitimate actual voters. And that was a legitimate concern that created the state's interest in alleviating the public's concern, the public's perception that there was the potential for vote fraud. Here in Wisconsin now, the federal law HAVA and their own Wisconsin statute 6.51 require the GAB and local clerks to cross-check before and after every election the voter rolls with the vital records office statistics of deceased voters. So we're constantly and continually purging our rolls of deceased voters. It's not an issue because of the federal and state law that's in effect now.
So your position is that those 333,276, none of those people were dead at the time that there was a computer run?
That none of them were dead?
Yeah.
I don't know if we would say that none of them were dead. I would say that, and we would say that the 333,000 is not a, in terms of the factual finding of the court, was not a precise estimate. It was a precise number. It was an estimate. But there is a relatively high degree of confidence now that the SBRS system does actually reflect who are eligible voters now in Wisconsin. And, in fact, the HAVA statutes and Chapter 6 provide procedures to be regularly purging the voters.
Well, let me ask this. When a person is married, a woman, and the name is changed, is that immediately reflected on the statewide voter registration system?
When names are changed?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, Jeff.
When people are divorced and they change their name, is that immediately reflected on the voter system?
I don't know the answer to that, Justice.
When people move out of state, is that immediately reflected on the voter system?
That I am aware that there are procedures to provide for checking addresses and ensuring that the voter rolls reflect accurate residents in the state.
Well, if someone living in Grant County moved to Dubuque, you're saying that that's immediately going to be reflected on the this voter system?
I believe the SBRS system allows and requires that voter address changes be reflected, and that there's an effort by the local clerks and the GAB to ensure.
How would they do that?
Pardon?
How would they do that? You're living in an apartment in Grant County. You move across the river to Dubuque. How is the clerk's office going to know that?
I think there are cards that are sent out.
The what?
Cards. I'm not certain, Justice, of the exact process that the GAB uses in terms of ensuring that the rolls are continuously purged. But the danger of voter impersonation has primarily come from the inflation of the rolls on account of deceased voters who are present on the rolls for whom someone can go vote for that person. That's been the source of much of the concern. But here in Wisconsin, we haven't even had any instances where we've had any arrests or convictions of voters who attempted to impersonate another voter. And one of the reasons... Yes,
At first blush, that's, and maybe you were going to answer this, you've mentioned that at least three times. And, in fact, that's what you led with. And as former prosecutor, I would hazard, and I'm sure the thought has crossed your mind, that there would be any number of reasons why there would not be successful prosecutions of those kinds of cases, some of which were highlighted by Justice Prosser's questions. And I would posit to you that there is absolutely no mechanism of which I am aware that would lead automatically to notice to the clerk's office that someone has moved out of state. So, given the difficulty of those kinds of prosecutions under these facts that the state is trying to prevent, I'm not quite sure the fact that there have been zero is exactly what you want to hang your hat on. So what I'd like to ask you to do is talk about what you believe the constitutionally impermissible burdens are.
We would say the burdens fall into two primary categories. First is which was the factual finding of the court, that procuring a photo ID can be a frustrating, time-consuming, and complex process.
And right, the same can be applied to a driver's license.
Secondly, it can impose a significant pecuniary cost, especially for an indigent voter.
How much?
Well, it's $20.
Okay, $20
to obtain a birth certificate.
So it's the money. It's the $20 that renders it unduly burdensome.
No, it's also, I think, it's also the record which we've created. That in terms of the inconvenience and the burdens and the difficulties, which we're not just talking about a situation which I think counsel for the interveners referred to as citing Crawford as part of life's vagaries. Rather, the court addressed this in the earlier case, and I think there was some confusion about this, about what's required. I think the Department of Transportation, after the law was passed, issued a number of documents and regulations which tried to set out what types of documents are available, what types of documents can be provided to comply with Act 23, because there are five things you have to essentially prove in order to get a Wisconsin Department of Transportation ID: your name, your date of birth, your identity, your citizenship, and your place of residence. What it really boils down to is, if you look at, there are exhibits 42 through 48 at the trial, where you had the list of documents identifying all the different laundry list of documents that might be provided. But what it really boils down to, what voters need, is you need a birth certificate and you need a Social Security card. You need a birth certificate to prove your citizenship and your name and date of birth, and you need a Social Security card in order to prove your identity. And in order to get your birth certificate, you have to go to either the county registrar or the clerk, or if they don't have it, you've got to go to the state's Division of Right of Records. And for your Social Security card, you have to go to the Social Security office. So we're talking about voters having to make two, three, four numbers of trips to different governmental agencies just to get an ID in order to go to the polls. We presented evidence from about 35 voters, where numbers of them were incurring 6, 8, 12 hours of time just to get a photo ID to vote. Now, this was foreseeable. We cited in our temporary injunction brief, the director of the GAB, Kevin Kennedy, even said when he was telling voters, he said, this is not going to be an easy process. It's going to be challenging. You're not just going to be able to go to one place and to go straight to the DMV and get your photo ID. It's going to take some time. You have to prepare. You have to plan. And the 35 voters who we presented evidence about, just like 333,000, they're all subjected to not just Act 23, but this statutory and administrative framework that exists outside Act 23, into which they're all plunged into to visit these different governmental agencies just to get a photo ID in order to vote. Now, at some point, spending 2 hours or 4 hours or 8 hours, that becomes a functional handicap, an impairment, an impingement upon folks' right to vote. In addition in addition to the $20. We have never, our state has never required voters who are trying to exercise the right to vote to have to go to several other different governmental agencies apart from the clerk's office in order to just go down and vote on election day. That's unprecedented. So these voters, they were illustrative of a significant burden. The other thing I'd like to point out.
Counsel, before you leave that, the $20 is the cost in Wisconsin. Do you have any, not everybody was born in Wisconsin, fortunately or unfortunately. And so what, do you have costs from other states, let alone Europe and Asia, South America and Africa?
Yeah, I think, you know, we had a number of voters whose evidence was presented. We had voters who were from Michigan. I think they had to pay $28. Some voters from Mississippi had to pay $18. I think there was one voter who used a kind of an internet service to get his birth certificate from California, had to spend $50. I think that was John Wolfe. The other problem we have is counsel for the interveners and the state have suggested that this is a non-discriminatory law. The effects of this law fall very unevenly upon certain sections of the electorate. We know that the non-possession rates for the elderly are far higher. Voters over the age of 65 is about a 12.5% non-possession rate. There's almost 750,000 voters who live in our state who are over the age of 65. So we're talking approximately about 100,000 voters. And for voters who are over the age of 80, 25%, nearly one in four elderly voters over the age of 80 do not have a photo ID. And we know that the non-possession...
I prefer you use mature rather than elderly.
Or senior. Or wise.
All right. Wise would do.
Or
wise would do.
Continue.
Go ahead, counsel.
One other factor, I think, which is not in our record, but we'd ask the court to take judicial notice. The AARP amicus brief, I thought, made a very probing point in their footnote 17, where they cited the United States Department of Health and Human Services study, which reported on the numbers of persons in the state of Wisconsin who were born without a recordation of their birth. Folks like, I believe, your father, didn't have a recording of his birth. Similar to Ruth L. Frank, who's one of the voters who presented evidence, who, by the way, is 93 years old, has voted in every single election in the state of Wisconsin since Dewey Truman. And these voters, there's approximately 11,000 mature voters there's no recording of their birth, and they have to basically administer either a civil action to get a birth certificate or initiate this procedure, which none of the voters who we had go through were ever told about it.
Why couldn't they go under 102.15.3b in the transportation?
Well, that's what I was referring to. I mean, I think that's a permissive. No, there's nothing that requires under that reg the WSDOT to actually provide and grant the petition. They certainly don't. There was no evidence in the record that they actually make it available. And it is essentially.
But why would they have a rule, Counselor, with all due respect, that they have no intention of using for anybody?
I mean, the evidence in our record with Ruth Frank and even.
You go and try to find out about this and try to employ this?
I believe she asked. I mean, I think there was a lot of back and forth in terms of the evidence, and when you look at the transcripts of her deposition, she maintained that she had to make several number of phone calls, and nobody ever told her about that until there were complaints lodged with, and her issue became public in the newspaper.
Did she get a photo ID? Can she
vote
now?
I don't think she did. I don't think she ended up getting one.
Still not now. With all the lawyers she's got helping her, you guys couldn't help her get an ID. My goodness.
You're looking for a permanent injunction, aren't you?
We are. We believe a permanent injunction. We believe that a facial challenge in this situation is appropriate, where there's under the standard of Washington State v. Grange, which was the standard that the Supreme Court utilized and said was the standard in Crawford for facial challenges, a substantial number of voters are clearly affected by this. And the test is not, we've two things. The test is not whether we have to have absolute disenfranchisement, and the test is not whether a majority of the voters are, or all of the voters are disenfranchised. But the question is, can this law be interpreted or applied in a way, in a manner that's constitutional to an election that was conducted in the state of Wisconsin? That's the correct way, the correct method to analyze whether a facial challenge is appropriate. And we would submit to you that there's no way the law can be interpreted. There's no way it can be applied. That if we had an election where Act 23 was employed, that the law, that the election would be conducted in a constitutional manner, because we know that thousands of voters will be excluded from the process.
Mr. Sachs,
yes,
if I can interrupt for a minute. One of the things that has troubled me as I looked at both this case and the earlier case, the first case clearly is a facial challenge. Both you and opposing counsel have talked about this as a facial challenge. However, both of you have also referred to Washington State Grange. I also looked at Citizens United and the concurrence by the Chief Justice. Is it fair to call this a modified facial challenge? Modified in the sense that we've got all kinds of evidence presented at trial in this case that we didn't have in the first case. Is that a fair characterization?
I think so. I mean, I think the thing that distinguishes this case from the Lee case is that there is a substantial record of both evidence. There's a substantial record regarding the evidence of what the burden is that this law has imposed upon voters, including its effect on particular groups. And there's also a record on the other side of the ledger, too, in terms of the question of fraud and whether or not this law will advance in the state's interest and will be effective in deterring fraud. And that's an important question. So this is a facial challenge. I do think sometimes some of the jurisprudence regarding facial challenge does get a little esoteric, and sometimes it's hard to actually decide when is this a facial challenge and when isn't it. And I think you saw that in Citizens United. Where Citizens United ended up being a facial challenge, even though it started out as an as-applied challenge. But here, this is the kind of case that we need a facial challenge. We need to declare the law facially invalid, because if we had an election that thousands of voters were excluded upon, that's not the kind of election we want to have. Not only because of the manner in which it affects the voters, but also because we want the representatives that are governing our institutions to be represented and selected by the entire electorate. That's what we all have an interest in, and that's what our Constitution provides for.
Counsel, in the circuit court, you advanced several arguments of equal protection, due process, and the one that the judge decided this case on. If you should lose here, are those issues still alive, or are they not alive?
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, okay, think about it. The second, I'll give you another question, so you kind of put that here and think here. You've spent time on the burdens. The interest here, as I understand it, is not a generic voter fraud, that is the compelling state interest advanced, but rather it is a specific type of voter fraud, and that is in-person voter fraud. Am I correct with that?
Well, we would say not? That, well, one thing, first, it's not, we would not concede that it's a compelling state, but it's a
legend, you know.
Right. Well, we would say that the state has a legitimate interest in deterring all types of fraud. Photo ID, as a factual finding made by the court, that this type of photo ID law is only effective. It's only the only type of fraud it would be effective in deterring would be
voter impersonation, and that photo ID would have no effect, would not deter the other types of irregularities that have been found to exist, like, for example, in the Attorney General's task force from 2008, there were 11 instances of felons voting. One of the instances, actually, of those violations, the displayed his Department of Corrections ID card when he tried to vote. The voter fraud in voter registration procurement, where procuring false names. That photo ID is not going to do anything for that. No, that was, I think, six instances of that from the AG's task force. So none of those types of fraud that the AG's task force identified and pursued from the 08 election when they looked at 3 million votes, none of those would have been affected by this law.
No, I was trying to think of, in light of the little discussion about eliminating the $20. That only works for Wisconsin. You can't eliminate $28 from Michigan or whatever it costs in California. But the state could pay it. So that would be, court could say, hey, eliminate the $20 and pay for any other reasonable costs for ID. I'm not sure that would do enough, because it wouldn't help people who didn't have a birth certificate in the United States that for any reason that couldn't have it. So I was thinking that the court would write in a provision that broad waivers would be allowed. Now there's just very limited waivers in the statute, right? So could say Department of Motor Vehicle or some other department could have broad waivers. Then I thought, well, you got to do it within 3 days to make it work in order for a provisional vote to work. So I thought, well, we could have somebody in the department at every precinct that would be able to grant waivers on the spot if it's that easy. I looked at the certificate of the department as to what you had to show, and I'm not so sure it's so easy on the certificate. We don't know the practice. But, I mean, what else would you have to do to make this valid? And then after I wrote all that in on my notes to uphold this law, if you're right and the state's wrong, I then said, well, that just totally undercuts the law, which is be tough on the ID you need.
Well, Justice Abrahamson, I think your question calls into question what the trial court found to be, that this law is the most, if not certainly amongst the most stringent of photo ID laws in the nation. And it's needlessly stringent in a lot of ways, in many ways, a plethora of ways. And rewriting it, I've always thought the court was disinclined to try to legislate. But there are a number of ways that this law is needlessly stringent, and in three basic areas, some of which you've heard. The first area is the number of IDs that are allowed. And we have a very limited number of IDs. And unlike states like Tennessee, which is also a stringent photo ID state, or Pennsylvania, which allow local and state and governmental other types of IDs. So, for example, a Department of Veterans Affairs photo ID card, which Ricky Lewis tried to use, would be allowed, or a county ID card would be allowed to be used. Some places allow employer photo ID cards to be used. So other types of photo IDs would have to be allowed. This law has a very, very limited number of photo IDs. The second area is the underlying documentation that's needed to get a photo ID is needlessly strict. Here you have to have a birth certificate. You have to have a Social Security card. That's the statutory and administrative fabric into which this law was sewn into. And, we'd have to somehow undo that. And many other states
Many other states, like Georgia and Tennessee, just simply allow voters to execute an affidavit of identity in order to get their birth certificates or to get to prove their identity. And the last thing is, which goes to the issue which Justice Gableman was talking about earlier about the provisional ballot and the fail-safe, is that this law has no fail-safe. If you do not have a photo ID on Election Day, you then only have 3 days in which to go and try to perfect a provisional ballot. But if you had these problems before, it's very likely you're going to have the same problems over the next 3 days in terms of being able to get your photo ID. And the availability of the DMV is pretty limited. I mean, there's only, I think, 30 of the 90 DMVs that are open more than 2 or 3 days out of the week. I think the only ones that are open on the weekend are here in Dane County. And I don't think there are any that are open after folks' regular workouts. So, but the fact is here, there's no fail-safe if you don't have it. Other states have different kinds of fail-safe, and the Supreme Court thought that was significant in Crawford because they allowed voters there who couldn't produce a voter ID on Election Day to execute an affidavit of indigency on, you know, to perfect their provisional ballot. Other states have other alternatives. For example, Arizona, which is a strict ID state, they allow voters who don't have photo ID to just show up with two other forms of ID that affirm their name and address. South Carolina, another strict ID state, they allow what's called a reasonable impediment exemption, where you execute an affidavit saying you had a reasonable impediment. So these are all different kinds of things that could be done to make this law not a needlessly restrictive law that really doesn't do anything to makes it not narrowly tailored at all to accomplish its ends.
Do you agree with the state that the trial court's what it labeled findings of fact about the credibility of the experts are findings of fact, and that the clearly erroneous standard applies?
Under State v. Barfoot, which is a decision from this case, holds that factual findings based upon the testimony of an expert are subject to the clearly erroneous standard.
What's the site on that? Do you know?
State v. Barfoot. I don't have the site.
Barfoot. Okay, got it. Thank you. Counsel, the red light's been on, so thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Sachs and Assistant Attorney General Kowski.
Thank you. I'd like to first address the Chief Justice's question, which I wrote down as, does this law promote widespread voting? Was that the question, Chief Justice?
Isn't that a public policy?
I think so, and I think the way I'd like to answer this question is with a quote from the U.S. Supreme Court. In Purcell versus Gonzalez, 549 U.S. at 4, the court stated that confidence in the integrity of our electoral process is essential to the functioning of our participatory democracy. Voter fraud drives honest citizens out of the democratic process and breeds distrust of our government. Voters who fear their legitimate votes will be outweighed by fraudulent ones will feel disenfranchised. And I think what the court is saying, if not coming out and saying it outright, is that those who feel that there is fraud might not vote, if they fear that their vote is going to be canceled out by a fraudulent vote.
And those who can't meet these qualifications won't vote.
That's correct.
So is it like in the criminal law, the old rule was you let one go free because you protect the rights of, you let 20 go because you protect the rights of one? I mean, what's the standard?
The standard, I think, that the state has presented is the correct standard, is the Crawford standard. The balancing test that Justice Crooks has pointed out is correct. With regard to the standard, I also want to say that this court, although it has characterized the right to vote as sacred, I believe is the word that's used, has never applied what it deemed strict scrutiny. If this court
all
did
those
that,
cases of the court were before Caroline. So they wouldn't have used the word strict scrutiny because it wasn't in existence. It was made up in a footnote.
That is correct. So all those cases that this court would be creating a new standard here if it applied strict scrutiny, at least in my opinion. And the Chief Justice is correct that it's all these cases are from the 1800s. They're pre-Caroline products, which I think is 1924 or thereabouts.
38,
sorry, thank you. Another point on scrutiny. Both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit declined to apply strict scrutiny in Crawford. And Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit decision pointed out that the right to vote is on both sides of the equation here. Therefore, strict scrutiny would be particularly inappropriate. Instead, a balancing test is more appropriate. I believe it was in the last argument, there was a point addressed regarding the use of either a certificate of U.S. citizenship or certificate of naturalization as a substitute for a birth certificate. And I just want to make the point that in the administrative code, trans 102.15, sub 3M, sub A5, it lists a U.S. certificate of naturalization as a way to prove citizenship. It also lists a U.S. certificate of naturalization as a way to prove one's name and date of birth under trans 102.15 sub 3 sub A 9.
So yes, I hope it needs renumbering.
It does. It's very complicated. Another point I'd like to make with regard to the state's interests, the interest in the prevention or deterrence of voter fraud. In this case, the plaintiff's own expert, I'd like to read you a quote from the record. This is the record, record entry 91 at page 69, lines 16 through 25. And on redirect examination, the plaintiff's expert was asked about whether someone essentially could impersonate another voter under current Wisconsin law, absent a voter ID requirement. And this is the exchange that occurred. Question, under current law, without the photo ID requirement, is it possible for a voter to conceal his or her identity when they come into a polling place? Answer, if they claim to be someone else who is on the rolls, that's conceivable. Next question, so they could claim to be another person who is in fact registered and announce their name as that other person? Answer, correct. So under current law, it is possible for someone to walk in, state your name and address, sign the poll book, and impersonate you. And I also want to point out in Crawford, the Supreme Court, although there was no evidence in the record of any such fraud ever occurring in Indiana's history, still upheld that law on a facial challenge. So the Supreme Court didn't require there to be proof presented by the state of in-person convictions or prosecutions of in-person impersonation voter fraud. So I think the court can look to the Crawford decision on that point.
Counsel, are you arguing that finding 27 of the circuit court, which says since 2004, voter fraud investigations have been undertaken. I think you're familiar with that. In essence, the final sentence says none of their efforts have produced prosecution of a voter fraud violation that would have been prevented by the voter ID requirement of Act 23. Are you arguing that that finding is clearly erroneous?
No. So? No, we're not.
Are you withdrawing your arguments about clearly erroneous findings of fact and that the expert Ken Mayer's computations are unreliable? Are you withdrawing those arguments?
I don't believe in the brief we made arguments that they were clearly erroneous.
Well, in fact, your standard of review sets forth a clearly erroneous standard. Why would it set forth a clearly erroneous standard if you weren't saying the findings of fact are clearly erroneous. I refer to page 5 of your brief that says, trial court findings of fact under the standard of review. Trial court findings of fact will be affirmed unless they are clearly erroneous. So is that about another case? That's
no.
About this one.
I don't recall an argument in the brief that we ever said that the findings are clearly erroneous, unless I'm mistaken. I did not write the brief, so I don't recall.
Standard of review.
Reviews on page 5 of the brief of chief.
Thank you. And I see my red light is off. I'll just say that the relief that we're requesting is that this court would reverse the judgment of the circuit court and that the injunction would be lifted and that Act 23 would be allowed to go into effect. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And so ends our argument in 12 AP 1652. beautiful Milwaukee branch of the NAACP versus Scott Walker. I want to thank Assistant Attorney General Kowski, Attorney Morley, and Attorney Sachs for their arguments on this voting case. It's interesting that most of the cases directly on point in voting cases are 19th century, two centuries ago. And but old law is good law, or mature law is good law. And Mr. Morley, you're no longer eligible to practice law in the state of Wisconsin, but we welcome a foreign, that is, out state, and you can pay our state bar dues, which are needed, and join us on a permanent basis. We are in recess until our next case. Are the our counsel for the next case present? Are they in hearing distance? Would you ask if it's if they would accept that the court will meet for that case at 1:45 instead of 1:30, so the court gets some time to have lunch. And but unless it's terribly inconvenient, we meet at 1:45. We are in recess, and thank you.
She gave